Pamela Twigg, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So you are an executive coach with archetypes, specializing in archetypes.
Yes.
It's very official.
I like to say about myself.
That's good.
Thank you.
So you and I have known each other for a little while now, mm-hmm. and you came over and we had a discussion about, you know, you were starting this coaching business and you kind of wanted about archetypes. And were you saying, like, do you think it's an accessible topic? Do you think a lot of people know about it? Do you think people would be willing to do this assessment and figure out what kind of archetype they were? Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, I know about archetypes, but, you know, I took a psychology class. And so I think that's part of it a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I also know how valuable they can be, especially working collaboratively with other people. So what got you interested in archetypes and when did you get started?
It was very interesting. I was exposed to this assessment when I was doing my certification training to become a coach. So I totally switched careers a couple of years ago. And mm-hmm. so I thought I need to be authentic and I need to make sure I have the right certifications to call myself a coach.
Okay.
So I was in the training and one of the modules, a lot of it is about self-awareness. And so we did several different assessments. And I did this assessment with the same one that we're talking about, the free assessment, and it came back and it had my leading archetype lover.
Oh, okay.
And my more offstage archetype was renegade. And I had this reaction of like,
Did you immediately connect with it or were you like, that's totally wrong?
It's almost as if it picture the assessment in the middle of the room mm-hmm. and I look at it and I kind of like kick at it and kind of walk away.
Okay.
It's yeah. like, I don't really know if I like that. Uh-huh. I didn't have an immediate, oh my God, I'm embracing this and I love this reaction.
Okay.
And it was only in really starting to unpack the meaning behind the assessment and like what that really, understanding that there are gifts to all of these parts of us, that I kind of relaxed into it and then realized I suddenly started seeing in every certain aspect archetypes, like everywhere I went or if I was watching the movies, looking. So it really was that first, I think, initial reaction of actually wanting to reject it.
Okay.
That got me interested and wanted me to kind of learn more to really appreciate.
So kind of festered a little bit in your brain.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So for people who have no idea what we're talking about, mm-hmm. what's a really simple explanation for what an archetype is?
It's the way I like to tell people about it is an archetype is like a human attribute. And it is in every single person, these parts of us. It doesn't matter what continent you live in, what language you speak. These are parts of the human genome. So I guess you'd like to say these are kind of our inner characters, our inner board of directors, and they are the parts of us that show our behavior.
Okay. So when I was thinking about this, do you find that if families do archetype assessments,
mm-hmm.
are they hereditary? Are they completely different? Is there some sort of overlap?
That's a good question. So archetypes can be core to who we are or mm-hmm. they can be current. So core is, yes, for example, if you're a little toddler and you're kind of doing a certain thing and the grandfather tells by the behavior, oh, you know, she's going to be a doctor. There are certain parts of us that are just natural and core to who we are.
Mm-hmm.
So those archetypes will likely always kind of be at the forefront no matter what you're doing.
Okay.
And then there are those archetypes that we say are current. And that really is, you know, depending on the situation, how do I need to show up? What do I need to develop to be able to, for example, if I'm going to be the CEO of a company,
mm-hmm.
I have to be very comfortable in taking center stage. I have to be very comfortable in explaining to other people the why of why we're all here.
Yeah.
And if that is not core to who you are, if you kind of tend to be a little bit shy, you tend to not want to have that focus. It doesn't mean that it's not in you, but it means that you have to develop that. And so developing that would be something that we would say is a current archetype. It's based on the situation that you're in now and where your focus is.
Can you change archetypes over time? I mean, I kind of like your core, yes, but like I don't know. The archetype mm-hmm. assessment that I did, I could see that as a very like that's probably my core. Mm. I would imagine. Mm. I don't see myself not being caring. I was a nurturer, FYI. It's just for people.
Yes.
Nurturer. So, I mean, I kind of can't see myself not caring because that's like, I was in the medical field for almost 20 years. Mm. It was a thing that was very in the forefront. And so you have to be sort of that at that level if you're going to do that.
Sure.
So yeah, so do you think that like that could change? Like, I don't know. I guess I could have a tragic event where I would be like a reckless.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. The whole point is, you know, the way that this assessment is and the way that this methodology is set up there are 10 archetypes within all of us. And the idea is that, yes, you know, you can develop and grow and shift. We're not the same person we were when we were 18. We're not the same person we were when I'm going to say when I was 30.
Uh-huh.
Because of experiences and circumstance, they shape us and we all develop and grow. And so, yes, you absolutely change over time and given a situation. If, for example, nurturer is not in my top. So the way the full assessment works is there are our leading actors and then they're more off stage.
Mm-hmm.
And leading actors are those three that are very prevalent. And then you have kind of supporting archetypes that step into easily depending on a situation. And then there are those archetypes for whatever reason, you either think they have little value or you've kind of grown up being told they have little value. So okay. You don't step into those easily.
Gotcha.
So those are the more off stage. And nurturer is not in my top three. And so, but for example, if I suddenly found myself needing to take care of an elderly parent, or perhaps I just had a newborn baby, nurturer is going to be much more present at that time. It really is. It's not who you are.
Yeah.
It's who you are being in that moment.
That's good. So I think that sometimes people might view archetypes as like, oh, I'm this one singular thing and I'm in this category. So therefore I am that person and I should really double down. And what you're saying is like, no, that's like your strongest trait, but that doesn't mean you can't step into other roles and actually develop those other attributes. So I think I don't think most people know that. I think that they're going to take an assessment and they'll say like, okay, so I'm this person.
Mm.
And I think people really are searching for somebody to tell them what to do.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think that it's easily, and when you say, oh, this is an attribute and you can, it's like a muscle, you can work it or not. It involves work. It's not just like this thing I can placate to, or I can default to. This is an excuse for my behavior. I think some people do that too, where they say like, oh, well, I'm just like this because of that. And I think it's good. So that's where the coaching aspect comes in. And I guess we should address the lead actor and the supporting actor. Was that based on the organization that you coach through?
The leading actor and the major and minor supporting actors and the more offstage actor, that has to do with, there are two co-founders to the methodology. One is Richard Olivier, who is the son of Laurence Olivier. And for some people who are listening, they will know who Laurence Olivier is. And
they
for
should.
Others, I think they should too.
Yeah.
But not everyone will know. Laurence Olivier was one of the most famous actors in, I would say,
Of stage and screen.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And so Richard was... at the time when he was thinking about archetypes, he was the artistic director at the Globe Theatre in London.
Mm.
And he was working on Henry V, which was going to be the opening play, the Shakespeare play.
For that season.
And, well, they were reopening the Globe Theatre altogether.
Oh, okay.
That was like 1995 or 96.
Yeah, because they rehabbed the whole thing,
yes.
Right?
Okay. Yeah, so he was the artistic director who was in charge of the opening. And Henry V, and of course... archetypes are very present in Shakespeare's writings.
Mm-hmm.
And Richard was thinking about at the time, okay, what archetypes are present in Henry V and inspirational leadership? And so when he was working with the actors, they were working on archetypes and they were working on, what does this archetype look like? How do we walk in with this archetype?
So character development with archetypes. Yeah.
And so that's one side. So hence, whenever, it's a metaphor and you can consider the 10 archetypes, your 10 inner board of directors, if you like.
Sure.
But because of Richard Olivier's influence, we talk about leading actors, mm-hmm. and we talk about major and minor supporting actors and your more offstage actor. The other side of the development of this methodology is Lawrence Hillman. And Lawrence Hillman is the son of James Hillman, who is considered the, I think in the U.S., the father of archetypal psychology. Mm-hmm. He studied under Jung. So Lawrence grew up in Switzerland. Basically, Lawrence will say he marinated in archetypes. So he had no other, you know.
He had no other guide.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Mm. And so he and Richard got together, and out of the experiences with Shakespeare and Henry V and the archetypes and Lawrence's side, they both came to the conclusion with all their experience that I don't even know how many archetypes there are.
Sure.
But they had decided these 10 are really prevalent in everyone. Mm-hmm. We see them, we recognize all of these 10. So that's kind of how they focused in on the 10 archetypes. And that's where you get the leading actors and the reference to stage.
I think it works because I think everybody is familiar with that. And I think you can have the lead role, which makes much more mm-hmm. sense. And then it's not a negative. So it's not like this is your strongest attribute and everything else after that is you're weak in. Mm. Instead of saying you're weak in something, it's sort of like, no, they're just as important. They're just not, you know, they play a part.
Yes, exactly.
But they're not necessarily on mm-hmm. stage the whole time.
And that's the whole concept. If you can imagine, you are the creative director, you are the author, you are the actors mm-hmm. in your own play.
Yeah.
And if you don't like how a scene is playing out, you switch it up.
Yep.
And so the whole idea is, yeah, and it's authentic. It's not saying, you know, well, I'm going to pretend that I'm this. Sometimes we need to act into something to be able to kind of make sure that it gets integrated in mm-hmm. who we are because it's a new experience. But these are truly characters that are already within you and you have access to them. If, you know, by not showing up in a certain way, that could have a cost to you. And recognizing what that cost may be and to be able to develop that part of you that needs to show up to change the situation. Because right. outcome happens. It's whether or not are you in front of it or behind it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that a lot of people have a tendency to say, well, that didn't happen because of outside sources, mm-hmm. maybe outside effects. And it's sort of like, well, yeah, that's true, maybe. But then it's also how you respond to those specific things. And if you're unaware that this is how your natural response mechanism might be, then you could say, well, okay, I understand that maybe I could have handled that differently.
Yeah.
And then, but also it's not negative. I like that this whole system is not a negative approach, meaning like you're wrong if you do this or that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just basically like, well, what could you have done better? And maybe this might be a better way of looking at it. And I like the idea that you can rewrite it or try different things, mm-hmm. try different hats on, so to speak, to see if you are uncomfortable, then why are you uncomfortable?
Yeah.
But again, it's you have to want to do this.
Right, right. I mean, yes, all of this does have to come from your own curiosity about who you are, mm-hmm. about how you're showing up, about your own self-awareness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, change, it can be uncomfortable. And so people have to be willing to be able to kind of explore and wonder what it may look like if they tried it in a different way. I mean, I like what you were saying, because this methodology, one of the reasons that it really then when I kind of relaxed into it mm-hmm. and understood is it's not judgmental. It's not saying, to your point, a topology of what a lot of assessments do. They're saying you are blue, you are this, you are a warrior.
Mm-hmm.
And so then it either says we as human beings don't change and evolve, and so I am just going to stay stuck.
Yeah.
And it also, to your point, can then reinforce someone being able to hide behind a certain way, to your point of if you're the leader of a team and someone has told you you are a warrior and not a nurturer, you know,
right.
then why do you have to show empathy toward your team? Why did, you know, every man for himself, I'm a warrior, I don't do nurturing, which is, you know, being able then to hide behind and say that I'm not taking responsibility for development and growth of myself and my team or my people.
Right. Yeah. And I also feel like, if you were to do this in a, like a workplace environment, mm-hmm. then it helps open up lines of communication that I don't think people would otherwise be willing to do or more open to do. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like, and it has to open up a level of people in a leadership position knowing it's kind of like learning styles with teaching. Mm-hmm. So you have people that are really like, I'm tactile. So I like to write things down. I work in a digital space, which is hysterical. So I'm a tactile person who has notebooks and lists and write things down. And that's how I remember things. And that's what works for me. And that's fine. But I also know some people are visual and some mm-hmm. people are audible, like they need the audio. And sometimes people just need to be in a room being all three of those things mm-hmm. at the same time. So, but with, if you're in a leadership position and you realize somebody needs a little bit more nurturing, then you can see that.
Yeah.
Or if somebody needs a little bit more of a firm hand to get things done, you need to be able to know, I'm assuming that would make everybody much more productive and seen and heard and mm-hmm. feeling like they're.
You're spot on. I mean, it's exactly that. And it's, to your point, it's not saying then, oh, you're being a bully. It's saying right now you are showing up as a bully because perhaps you're under pressure, you're stressed. Right. Mm-hmm. It's not saying that that's who you are. It is who you are being in that moment. And there's this level then of non-judgment in a way, because it's recognizing that that's not who you are. It's given the situation. And if we can be aware of that, we can pull back and be more effective.
Yeah.
And the other, it was interesting. You're talking about leaders being able to tap into this. I was talking to, she happened to be, I think a week ago, I don't think she is anymore, the chief strategy officer at Verizon Global. And she and I were talking about this methodology and she was pointing out that for her, what we were talking about before, the normally assessments and leadership development, what they do wrong is they label people and they do the topology that you're talking about. And with something like this, with this methodology, understanding that it's a multiplicity, that we step in and out of these, we're not just one at any time. You and I are talking and we're unpacking them as if they were one, but we show up often in a combination of different archetypes at a certain time. And her point was, given AI, for example, if you take a leader who's a chief financial officer, a lot of their time, you know, we kind of all have an image of what a CFO is and sometimes a little bit curmudgeon-y, risk averse, very
spreadsheet.
Yes. Not very nurturing, not very approachable. But given AI, you know, part of their job can be done differently. They're not going to be needed necessarily to be the one who analyzes all the data. What's going to be really important as a leader in that is then developing that human side of yourself.
Yeah.
And that's what this does. This is allowing that development from a human perspective.
I think that corporate structure tries to take a lot of the humanism away from people because there are deadlines and you're hitting a quota and quarterly meetings and blah, blah, blah. And I think it takes away some of that nurturing abilities or the creativity side sometimes. So I think this is nice to have. Maybe AI will alleviate some of the hard edges that you need to have and it can kind of soften a little bit and make it maybe a much more enjoyable environment for people to work in.
Yeah. Imagine it. I mean, you know, obviously it doesn't mean because we're developing these archetypes and you're developing a certain type, it doesn't mean that hard conversations still don't exist.
Right, exactly.
It doesn't mean that deadlines go away and that, you know, in the end, a company is there to be profitable.
Right.
Which means behaviors are expected. But what this allows for is it allows to kind of recognize, to your point of, you know, who am I being right now? How do I need to show up so that I can be my best self? And obviously when we're feeling, and we know that physically, right? Physically, emotionally, mentally, when we are not feeling our best selves, we perform very differently. And if we're performing from a space of fear or the inability to feel like we're seen and heard, our production and our performance is much different whenever we feel like, okay, you know, I'm not being judged as to who I am in the sense of how I'm showing up. I'm, you know, we are actually allowing more of a dreamer archetype to show up to be able to brainstorm and create ideas.
You create safe spaces for that type of behavior. But I think it's valuable for leadership, especially to do this, because then they can figure out, okay, so I'm showing up in this role that could be like super intimidating to a lot of people. And so how do I kind of curb that in certain times and then really dial it up when it's important?
Yeah.
And I think it's also funny because my offstage character is creativity or dreamer, which is like a creativity.
It's in the creativity realm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And which is funny because I do marketing. So I feel like, oh, that's interesting.
But that, you know, it's funny too, because sometimes, for example, you're doing marketing and you're doing a lot of creativity in that sense. And sometimes if an archetype is not perhaps core to who we are, the work that we do or the people we interact with kind of represent that archetype as well. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking about this. My more offstage is renegade, dreamer and renegade.
Yep.
And I was thinking too, dreamer, gosh, that kind of made me sad. You know, like.
Yeah. I was like, oh, I don't know if I like that. Yeah, and then I was reading it and I was like, no, that's pretty accurate. It's pretty spot on. Because I, you know, I'm very big picture kind of person and saying like, okay, why we do this. I can be really creative and it could be really good in the moment, but I'm always thinking like what's the longevity of this? And then also like I will do the thing everybody does. Oh, if you win the lottery, right? Like everybody I'm assuming would have that fantasy, right? Like what would you do if you win the lottery? And you allow yourself to have these like crazy things. And then you always come back to, well, you know, you don't buy the second house because then you have to pay the taxes on it.
Yeah. Right. It's like, talk about kill. That's like in, you know, to your point about dreamer in a corporate setting. Yeah. How many times, you know, have people been in meetings and, you know, we need to brainstorm things aren't going well. But somebody's like, oh, you know, oh, I have this what if, because that's a great one for dreamer. What if? If you want to trigger and kind of activate dreamer, the what if. And then the next person beside them says, oh yeah, been there, done that, didn't work.
Yep.
It's like, okay, that's a killer. That's like squashing the dreamer right there. And it sounds like you're very good at internally doing that for yourself.
Oh God, all the time. And I sometimes I do it for other people. Somebody says they want my opinion on something. And I said, okay, do you want my opinion or do you want what you want to hear? Because those are two different things sometimes. Yeah. And then they'll say, well, no, I really want your opinion. And I said, okay, you're consenting to my opinion. You might not like it.
Yes.
But sometimes it's important to hear that. I'm assuming it's important to hear that. Because I would want somebody to tell me if I was like pretty close to the cliff of doing something that's probably not smart. So, I kind of self-regulate that a little bit because it's, I think also it's good to have dreams, but it's also good to be realistic about how to approach those.
Yeah. I mean, a dream, you know, is only as good as the plan that comes after the dream, right? Mm-hmm. I think I don't know his name, a Stanford professor who studies ideation. And he said one time it takes like 2,000 ideas to generate one profitable one.
Yeah.
So imagine the cost to you if you're not allowing yourself to have those moments of those. I mean, 2,000 is extreme, but if you're already kind of editing in the moment of what you might actually be killing off that might be potential or possible or how that might be affecting the other person with you who's kind of brainstorming as well.
Yeah, I have gotten better at being like, okay, let's just roll down the path here. Because I work with two other people that are creative on my team. And so for me to just be like, no, that's not going to work. I have curbed that a lot because I was like, okay, let's see what happens because it's the potential of it happening or I can say, I think that's a good idea, but these are the potential pitfalls I see. Mm-hmm. So how can we maybe avoid those? Or maybe I'm looking at it from the wrong perspective. Can you tell me how you think that would work? And I think that approach is a little bit better and it has actually worked to my advantage in that particular thing. Or they'll say, oh my God, I didn't even think about that. And then, that won't work at all. But they come up with that conclusion on their own. That's helpful.
Yeah. And I think, you know, dreamer, there are certain archetypes where when we mention them, we have already kind of a perception of them. Dreamer is one of them. I think a lot of times when we talk about dreamer, people then suddenly think, oh, head in the clouds, you know, pull back down, you know, get back down to reality. Mm-hmm. It's seeing kind of what we call the shadow of too much.
Yeah.
In the dreamer. And so then we automatically recognize that part of it and think, oh, I don't want to have that, rather than understanding that every single archetype has certain gifts that bring with it. And when you're able to tap in it with the gifts, that's where the benefit comes.
Right.
And so to your point, what you're doing is also, if that is not one that you step in too easily, surrounding yourself with people who do, to be able to kind of activate that for you as well. I have the same with Renegade.
Yeah.
I recognized that actually most of my best female friends have Renegade as their leading archetype, which was interesting. Nice. Yeah. And so you're able to kind of step into that in certain ways through others as well, which helps activate it within you, if that makes sense.
I did find when I took the assessment, and we were talking earlier before we turned the microphones on, that some questions I had a visceral response to, positive or negative, but it was sort of like, oh no. And, or, oh yeah, yeah, kind of, you know, so, but it's interesting that you then at the end, now this is only two, and I would recommend that you do the free assessment, because why not?
Yeah, exactly. Why not?
And then, but you can kind of see like, oh yeah, that's definitely, this makes sense. And then you can see the offstage actor for what it really is, which is sort of like, yeah, okay. But that kind of, am I a dream killer? And then you're like, no, that has nothing to do with it. Cause then you read the assessment and you're like, yeah, well, I do all these things. Mm. So, but I also know that, I think a lot of it has to do with influence, because my father is from New England. He's a salty New Englander. Mm. And, you know, his mom and dad were first generation. And so there's a little bit of like, you don't have...
Be practical.
You don't have the luxury of being a dreamer.
Yeah.
Because you came from a really probably... Well, I know they both came from very not great... They were displaced. And so they were in refugee camps and they got here. So it's sort of like, you don't have the luxury of thinking you can do the thing that you might want to do. You have to be practical, right?
Yeah.
So that's why I was like, I wonder if this is hereditary in nature because of just circumstance. And I think it does play an influence, but I also feel like hopefully the further you get from that trauma, you might be able to allow yourself to do a little bit more dreaming. Yeah.
I think it's exactly that. Some of the archetypes where you said you had that reaction, and I had that, it was interesting. I had that, you know, I got upset that Renegade was my more offstage, to your point. And yes, it totally is that. I wouldn't say, I guess maybe it's just a terminology for me, not hereditary, but to your point of that, those were kind of the thoughts and beliefs and the behaviors that were handed down to you. So there is a generational influence into which archetypes we value and which we don't.
Right.
And that's exactly, to your point, why for you, possibly you were learning, you know, dreamer. Oh, you know, we don't have time for that. Oh, that's, you know, that's ridiculous. You know, you need to put your head down. You need to focus. You need to get, you know, we need to earn money. We need to be.
I think you're allowed to be a dreamer when you're young. And
yeah.
then I think that there's a definite turning point when you're probably if high school age, that shift happens where you're like, then the focus becomes on, okay, your grades, and then your grades dictate what colleges you can go to. And then your colleges dictate what kind of careers you're going to be going into. And then it's very much that. So I feel like you're hyper aware of those things at 15, which I think is like, crazy when you think about it.
Yeah, but and it's not even directly the message. It's so interesting that you say that, because in organizations, I can tell you of like, you know, in the full assessment, you have 10 archetypes. Almost always dreamer shows up as either in, we're not just showing up individually. We can also show up as a team, right? Mm-hmm. Dreamer is very, very, very underrepresented in organizations. And it's to your point. And I'll say to like leaders when we're doing workshops and things, growing up, we tell our children, you can be anything. What if? Think really big. And then at a certain point, I didn't think about college and all of that.
Yeah.
We don't want that represented at all. So we spend all this time telling our children to dream big, think that anything's possible, and then we squash it by the time we're in the corporate space or when we're in our professional space, whatever that may be.
Right.
And that potential that's there, we're limiting ourselves, but it is interesting that we do that. And that does show up in that way with corporations. And when they're allowing people to kind of have those moments and allow them. It's not that everybody's going to suddenly walk around and be like, oh, where am I? It's all, you know, it's not all, we're all playing ping pong forever, or we're all meditating endlessly. Right. It's really just allowing those opportunities to think of potential.
Yeah. I mean, I read a book last year. It's Rick Rubin. He's the producer. It's called The Creative Act. And he talks about creativity in a way that I had never thought about it. Meaning like there's all these great ideas and they're kind of in an idea river, and you can, they're endless. Like they're there. Some will appear to you and you can say, oh yeah, that's a really great idea. And if you're not capable of making that idea happen, then that idea will go someplace else. So it's sort of like, oh my God, I had that idea. You stole that idea. No, they didn't. They had the tools to make that idea happen. That's why that idea went to them. And I thought that was an interesting way of putting it. But also he says that your happiness cannot, you can have a job to live. Like you can work to live, but your, that should support you. And then you can also find your creative outlet too. So maybe your work supports your creative outlet, but those two things don't necessarily have to be one and the same, which I thought was an interesting way of putting it. So, you know, you do have these like weird societal pressures to do, you do one thing.
Yes.
And it's sort of like, well, yeah, I can do that one thing, or I can do this thing and this thing. Like the advent of this side hustle is really what he's talking about. It's sort of like, well, that's what I really love, but I've got to do this other thing to do what I really love.
Because I have to make money.
Because I have to eat.
Yes.
And I have to have shelter, and I have to have the basics. So he's like, so there's nothing wrong with being a barista that is able to make beautiful coffee and support yourself. And then at the same time, you're doing something else that you find your passion in, and that's your creative outlet. So, I mean, that was a really helpful way for me to just kind of say, oh, yeah, those two, being successful and a job doesn't mean that you have to make the most money or like that.
Right.
I think that mind shift is happening already. And so I think that people have gone to college for a specific thing and they don't do the thing they went to college for. I think that's really common. And I know now that I think this was really important for especially people going into the workforce. To know is that, you know, it has changed dramatically. Like you don't have people working at the same company for 30 years.
No.
Like that is,
no,
that's gone. You know, you're just climbing the corporate ladder or moving, making lateral moves and figuring out what you want to do. And I feel like people are much more in tune with that now than I think they were 4 years ago.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And to your point of, you know, perhaps part of you has this other side hustle or this passion that you don't bring to your professional life.
Right.
I would argue, again, it's that ability not to be labeled, that multiplicity of who we are. And I will say that tapping into that part of yourself, allowing yourself to kind of have that outlet, so to say, in another area does show up. It does, because we are one person.
Yeah.
We, you know, that still will have, I believe, a positive impact on how you may view your work or how you may feel about your current situation, being able to kind of tap into all those parts of yourself and giving them the space is very, very valuable to your overall success, whatever you want to define as success and happiness, if that's what, you know. Kind of, this is not necessarily a wellness being in a happiness session, but
no,
to be able
but
to
I mean,
tap
it's
into that.
Just to kind of, yeah, but it's a part of it. It's it's a big part of it.
Yeah.
And I think if you're in a corporate structure and you have staff coming and working for you, that you have to also understand that this is not the whole, this is not making a whole person happy, right?
No, like, exactly.
So you have to kind of come into the structure saying like, okay, I got this guy. He's really good at this, but he also like loves mountain biking and whatever.
I see the whole person.
You see the whole person.
Yeah.
Right. So I think that this might help see the whole or actually spark somebody to ask more questions about the whole person in general.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I think in Gen Zs and millennials, they do see who they are. I think 70% of them said it is defined by how they feel about their work. And to your point about, it's not that they're actually, what they're looking for is authenticity. And this is a way for leaders to be able to tap into who they are authentically and right. to be able to kind of nurture that yeah. within their team. And that's what people are wanting. It's yes. not, you know, I want you to be the best spreadsheet analyst ever. I want, you know, I want the best program ever written right. with deadlines and right. updates.
It's like you want the best productivity out of your team that you can get.
Yes.
But doing it in a way that's not like killing spirits, and because that's not, you're not getting anywhere right. with that. You want to be respectful and, you know, you're just treating them like human, like good humans. Yeah. And I think that sometimes that's not part of a corporate structure, but it should be. Mm-hmm. And you're right. I mean, I've younger people, I'm millennial and I'm an elder millennial.
No, she's not.
I am. you know, so I'm an, no, it's been blatantly obvious in the past couple of weeks. I've been having these meetings with younger people, and they're millennials, but I'm definitely the elder of that spectrum. And they're saying like, no, at the end of the day, like I close my laptop and I'm out. And having owned my own business and now working for myself, it's like, how do you do that? And they're also working for themselves, but they're just like, no, this, my job doesn't own me. I close my laptop at 5 o'clock and I go live my life. And you're just like, okay, so there's a definite shift in that where they're like, no, I'll work for you, but I want to make sure that your goals are aligned with what I'm
yes,
going to do.
Exactly. Yeah. That sense of purpose and the why. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of companies and different initiatives talk about trust, but to me, trust is a byproduct of what we are talking about.
Yeah, totally.
And what they want is, yeah, recognize who you are, that sense of purpose. Why are we here?
Mm-hmm.
And being treated well. That's what matters.
Yeah. So your coaching is probably very beneficial for individuals as well as companies.
Yeah.
Do you have a preference on who you particularly work with, or?
I've been coaching many different age groups, many different, I guess, where they are in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting. I really love being able to work individually in the sense of having what I call deep coaching. So having that much deeper sense of what's going on, because if you don't get to the core of what's really the problem, you can't change it.
Right.
And so individual coaching really allows that. So I love that part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And what I also really love is doing team development and team workshops, because when there's a collective, a collective energy or a collective vulnerability within a group, that does allow them to kind of make that shift or that change quicker than on an individual basis,
sure.
if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And oddly, it was really funny when I first started out with coaching. I was like, because I have 20 some years in a corporate setting, and I was like, oh, I'm not going to coach executives, or I'm not going to coach, you know, C-suite, you know, not doing it.
Yep.
I actually really love that.
See, that's yes. So I left the medical field. I just had the same realization 2 weeks ago, where I was like, medical, I don't want to know. I don't think I want to do marketing for medical things. And then I was like, oh, wait, no, I'd really be good at that. That was 2 weeks ago. We're 4 years into that transition. And I just was sitting here going like, why am I fighting this so hard? This is so stupid. Like, why am I not doing the thing that I have so much background in? So yeah, no, I get it.
Yeah. And it's like,
that just smacked me in the face. Yeah. About 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. And why was it that you were?
Why was it that I was so resistant? I think it was just because I was trying to redefine myself in a space that, you know, we live in a small town. And so I was very much known as this one particular thing, because people love to put people in boxes.
Yes.
And so I was very much well known for this one thing. And people were devastated when I stopped doing it. And then for me to kind of say, well, I don't do that, but I do this now. And like, is this acceptable? And it's like, is this cool? And can I do this? And then, but now I'm finding that those same people are going, oh yeah, well, she used to do this, but now she does this. So it's like, I think there was it was definitely a transition point. And then when somebody asked me about, they were just a friend of mine. They said, hey, I need to pick your brain about something, which I think should be a rate, by the way, like a pick your brain rate, just putting that out there. It would be like, you can ask me any question you want and I'll give you anything, but I'm not writing anything up. And this is just all verbal and it's whatever. And but there should be a pick your brain rate.
Yes. I love that. I'm going to steal that.
Totally. Yeah. But my whole thought process, they're asking me this question, like, we can't do that because you can't do this in this regulation, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, how do you know all of this? And I was like, well, I used to do this. And then they're like, well, have you ever thought about blah, 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 blah? And I'm like, no, I mean, I can, but it's like, I don't know if I really want to focus on that. And then the person I work with goes, why are you fighting this so hard? And I went, you know, I don't know. And then I was talking to Tim about it. And then Tim goes, yeah, you should. I think you just probably need to maybe allow this to happen. And I said, okay, you know, maybe I should start. Maybe am I crazy? And so now it was just a shifting point of just two people that I really trust going, why are you putting this ball up?
Isn't that funny? Yeah.
And I think it was because I was fighting so hard to get out of the shadow of that I didn't want to get sucked back into it. And it was. I mean, no, don't get me wrong. Medical profession is extremely stressful and it burns you out and it happens fast. And it happens before you realize it. So
that's one area, by the way, I think could do a lot of archetype
100%
coaching.
A lot of egos, a lot of.
And if you think about it, patients are always showing up in the shadow of too much because obviously they're in pain. Yeah. So.
Oh, I got
it. Great area to tap into.
Yeah, for sure. So I think that can be for anybody.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And I think it's the thing that you're running away from because you're like, I feel safe in this space now because I've created this space. And do I really want to let this thing back in? And it's sort of like, yes, but I have more tools now than I did prior. And then it's that self-confidence to be like, okay, I think I could probably handle. I think I could manage this better now. So that's, that's happened to me in the last 2 weeks. So I get why you're like, I don't want to work with corporate people. And then you're like, but those are kind of more people.
And it's, you know, I'm someone who a lot of times can be direct or, you know, I may say things that I don't dance always around the topic. And when you are in that space and you're at that certain, you know, you've had to deal with a lot. You've had to take a lot. There's a lot of, you know, going on with you. And so I find that there's kind of, I know this term is probably not to be used anymore, but kind of like that alpha ability to show up, and you have to be able to deal with that. And when you can deal with that and kind of break through that, that armor, a lot of work gets done.
100%.
A lot of work. And it's really rewarding. Every client's journey is my journey.
Right. Because you're like the biggest cheerleader right alongside of them. Yeah, I find that to be anytime they're asking for help at this point. So they're kind of contacting you saying like, we think this would be good because we definitely don't have all the answers and we are kind of looking for a consult here. And then you go, okay, well, then we're going to do this. And then you kind of like you're right. It's just like peeling back these layers slowly in a non threatening way.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that helps in a corporate setting or a personal setting too.
Yeah. Because we're all human and you know, there's a lot of, I'm going to be very kind of making statements that maybe some people are not going to agree with, but a lot of people in the CE level, they are just as insecure as other people.
100%.
And have imposter syndrome. And it's really interesting archetypally as well. How many C-suite executives do not have sovereign in their top three and also kind of more minor? And it's like, if you are the CEO, for example, and you can't go out and you can't explain to other people and inspire people as to why we are all here. If you hide when there's difficulty, if you don't like to step into that, that has a huge cost in an organization because everyone else is watching you. Everyone else is taking their lead from how you are showing up or how you are not showing up. And if you kind of are afraid to be out there and answer questions when, for example, an organization is going through change and hiding, people are going to say, oh my God, we got to jump ship. This is really good. If you can't see the CEO, where is, you know, he or she, what's going on? You have to be able to step into that. It may not be your most core to who you are.
Yeah.
But in that position of leadership, you have to be able to step into that part of yourself to be able to lead others.
Yeah. I had a friend of mine, she's a psychologist, and I am terrible at public speaking.
Mm.
Funny. Because I do a podcast, but it's fine because it's just me and
maybe
you.
Put some heads.
Maybe just yeah. Go out on stage on with a microphone yes. and a headset, but I can only hear myself. No, one-on-one, I'm fine. Groups, I'm fine. Great, no problem. Put me in front of a group of strangers with a microphone
staring at me
with like it's very quiet, and then you just hear like the hard candy wrapper opening. Mm. That's my worst nightmare.
And your own heartbeat.
Oh God, I'm like yes. shaky knees, sweating. It is yes. not pretty. I have done it twice. I've not been thrilled about it either time. And I talked to her about it. I was like, I hate the public speaking. Mm. I just can't do it. No confidence there. And she says, well, you have to, it's the Superman effect where you have to like, you go into a place and then you come out as this person who is not you. Mm. You are acting as somebody else to do this thing mm-hmm. that you have to do for a short amount of time. And then you can go back to being Clark.
Yes.
And I said, that's an interesting way of putting it. I said, although I think my brain would outsmart me on that one.
Yeah. I mean, these are very clever into convincing us of yes. many different things.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, you're not alone. A lot of executives have a fear of public speaking.
Yeah. But I think that's different because I would feel comfortable talking to people that I was working with on a day-to-day basis.
Mm.
But I don't know if I would, I don't know. I think that everybody has imposter syndrome, a level of imposter syndrome. It doesn't matter how old you are.
Like 80% of the population has had at some point been dealing with imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
It's quite high. And yeah, that's why kind of, mm-hmm. you know, being able to your point, tap into, you know, why am I here? What is it that I want people to know? It's not about me.
Right.
It's so not about me. It's mm-hmm. about what it is, that sense of purpose. Why I'm here with that message and really kind of honing in on that. They're not watching me. It's about what I want to say. But yeah, right. that's easily said for me too. If I have to speak in public, I'm like, you know, okay,
can't
breathe, breathe, breathe. And then my voice goes like this.
Oh God. And then at the yes. end of it, I'm like, I need to go lay down.
Yes.
No.
It's like, I feel sick.
Yeah. Someone's like, you should give this speech. And I was like, how about this? How about I write the speech? I can record it and you could just play it and I can just,
yes.
you know, whatever.
I think a lot of people would love to be able to do that.
I think
it
would be much more beneficial for my own mental health for me not to have to do public speaking. And I did tell members of our, the Allegheny County government that I'm like, I can't, I'm not doing this again. Thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it, but no, thank you.
But you tried.
I did.
Next time will be different.
Next time will be different. It hasn't happened in over a year. So I've got a good streak going. Mm. Hopefully that continues. Mm. But so if people want to get in touch with you to do this Archetypes at Work, where can they get in touch with you?
You can email me.
Mm-hmm.
It's Pamela@pjtwig2gs.com.
Okay.
And 301-338-0409. Probably the best. I have a website. It's PamelaTwigCoaching.com.
Okay.
You can also reach me there, but text, email.
All right. Well, we're going to have links in our show notes so people can take a look at it there. And then we'll also put links to the Archetypes at Work website so people can take the free assessment if they would like to do that. Well, this has been fantastic.
Yeah,
you should
thank
come
you.
Back anytime and good luck. I hope you get all the corporate clients you can stand.
Or individuals.
Yes.
I'm not saying I don't want you. I do want all of you. Yes. Just surprised at myself. Thank you very much. It's been a lot of fun.
Good. I'm glad.
This was my first podcast ever.
Well, I'm glad
so
I could be the first.
Thank you
yeah.
for nurturing me along the journey. It was, for those of you who have yet to do a podcast, you need to do it with Lydia. It was painless.
Good.
It was fun.
Yeah, and I have a big black lab named Jack, so you know he's a good icebreaker for sure.
Yeah, so thank you very much for the opportunity, and I'd love to hear from people doing the free assessment what they thought.
Absolutely, sounds good.
Thank you.
For more information on what you've heard on today's show, please visit our website, and that's recordtalklisten.com. While you're there, you'll find all of our previous episodes there for you to listen to for free. And if you're feeling fancy, we suggest you subscribe to the podcast so you never miss another episode. This has been another episode of Record Talk Listen, where I hit record, people talk, and hopefully you listen. Until next time, thank you so much.